interview with jailed activist Lori Berenson from her prison cell in Lima, Peru. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military fired explosives today at the offices of the Hamas movement in the West Bank town of Nablus, killing at least seven Palestinians, including a senior Hamas leader. This according to witnesses and doctors. The raid came a day after six Palestinian activists were killed when a roadside car parts store exploded outside Nablus. All belong to the Fatah movement, headed by Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Israel's policy of targeting suspected militants and Palestinian security forces believed to be involved in attacks has provoked outrage among Palestinians. Under threat of a U.S. boycott, delegates from over 100 nations began a final effort to salvage the World Conference Against Racism. Going quickly into talks yesterday, they agreed to remove from the agenda discussions on whether Zionism amounts to racism. The action came at the same time as the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution urging the conference to avoid debates on the issue. The White House last week threatened to boycott the U.N. conference in Durban, South Africa, if organizers include discussions on whether Zionism amounts to racism and on reparations for slavery and colonialism. The two-week negotiating session had to be squeezed into the month leading up to the conference because what was supposed to be the final planning meeting in May ended in deadlock. One of the first acts of yesterday's session was to exclude the International Gay and Lesbian Association from the conference. A British judge today overturned a ban on U.S. black activist Louis Farrakhan entering the country, brushing aside government arguments that he might stir up racial tension. Farrakhan is the Chicago-based head of the Nation of Islam. He's been excluded from Britain since 1986 after the government raised concern about his effect on community relations. This news from India. Three more men were arrested in connection with the killing of the bandit queen, outlaw-turned-MP Phoolan Devi. She was killed by gunmen outside her New Delhi home last week. Devi's career was unique in Indian politics. Born in 1963 into a low-caste family in a small village in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, she became notorious in 1981. When she was accused of orchestrating the murder of 22 upper caste men who were said to have gang raped her. After the killing, she fled from police and hid for 2 years in the forests of the central state of Madhya Pradesh, living by banditry. In the public mind, she became the equivalent of an Indian female Robin Hood, and the government, unable to capture her, was forced to make a deal. Devi surrendered to police in 1983, and after serving an 11-year jail sentence, was released on parole. She became known internationally in 1994 when she was portrayed in the film Bandit Queen, a huge success both in India and abroad. After being released from prison, she vowed to fight for rights of lower caste people and became a parliament member in 1996. Devi said in an interview before her death, "Politics has changed my life. I am no longer a bandit whom everyone hates, but a leader." This news from Mexico, some 500 protesters marched on the U.S. consulate in Acapulco, demanding $1.5 million in back pay for 10,000 Mexicans hired to work in the United States during World War II. And some 500 Zapatista sympathizers blocked roads in the southern state of Chiapas yesterday to protest against a recently ratified indigenous rights law they say fails to protect Indians. Mexico ratified landmark constitutional reforms in early July that were meant to strengthen Indian rights, but the reforms were rejected by key states with large indigenous populations and by the Zapatista rebel leadership. The leaders denounced the final version of the reforms as a mockery of their demands and an obstacle to peace, arguing that it gutted the original proposal for greater self-determination by Indian communities. Scientists are warning that smallpox, anthrax, and the plague could make a comeback because of increasing worldwide research into biological weapons. Their concern follows the case of a U.S. microbiologist who became infected with glanders, a potentially fatal disease which had not been recorded in the U.S. for more than 50 years. The 33-year-old man who worked at Fort Detrick, the top-secret U.S. Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, recovered from the highly contagious illness after 6 months of treatment. The disease, which was used by Germany as a biological weapon during the First World War, had been effectively eliminated from the West, and the microbiologist was the first reported human case in English-language medical literature since 1949. In an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, a team of specialists said the incident highlights the frightening possibilities still presented by a range of almost forgotten diseases. Says this case may serve as a harbinger of the resurgence of nearly forgotten diseases such as glanders, plague, smallpox, and anthrax. Research on these diseases is now being conducted in more laboratories, which increases the risk of occupational exposure. A congressional report released yesterday documented widespread physical, sexual, and verbal abuse of nursing home residents in the United States and warned that the problem is appearing to get worse. Congressman Henry Waxman of California, the ranking Democrat on the House Government Reform Committee, requested the investigation and introduced legislation that would create new safeguards for the 1.5 million people who live in the nation's 17,000 nursing homes.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring? To know the bell of freedom still rings. The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that comes. Stop and see. Babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve.
Stevie Wonder singing before the UN General Assembly as they celebrated his 40th birthday from the Robert Knott Archives here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the 20th anniversary of the death of former Panamanian dictator General Omar Torrijos, the man who negotiated the Panama Canal Treaty. Torrijos ruled Panama for 13 years after launching a military coup in October 1968 until his death in a plane crash on July 31, 1981, when he was replaced by General Manuel Noriega. In the U.S., Torrijos is best remembered for negotiating the 1977 Panama Canal Treaty with President Jimmy Carter. The treaty returned the Panama Canal Zone to Panama in December of 1999, after nearly a century of U.S. control. In 1980, Ronald Reagan ran for president against Carter based on his opposition to the Panama Canal Treaty, which he said was a violation of U.S. sovereignty.
The Panama Canal Zone is sovereign United States territory, just as much as Alaska is, as well as the states carved from the Louisiana Purchase. We bought it, we paid for it, and General Torrijos should be told we're going to keep it.
Unfortunately, most people in this country still have no idea how the Panama Canal was built or how the U.S. gained control of the canal and the land surrounding it at the turn of the century. Well, a new book, How Wall Street Created a Nation, J.P. Morgan, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Panama Canal, may help to set the record straight and return to the people of Panama a bit of their history in the process. It involves powerful Wall Street bankers and lawyers, secretive financial dealings, and a U.S.-engineered military coup that led to Panama's secession from Colombia. In other words, a classic American story. We're joined right now by Ovidio Diaz-Espino, who grew up in Panama, has worked as a lawyer in a number of New York law firms, including J.P. Morgan, and he is author of the book, How Wall Street Created a Nation. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, You say that you stumbled on this untold story of how Wall Street created Panama. How did it happen?
I went to a... I was working in Wall Street at that time as a regular lawyer for J.P. Morgan, and I went to a Christmas party in 1997 when a man named Webb Stone approached me and began to say, "Do you realize that the Republic of Panama was born on room 1162 of the Waldorf Astoria? Do you know that J.P. Morgan was the treasurer of Panama during its first year of independence? Are you aware that the Republic of Panama was conceived by the attorney William Nelson Cromwell, the founder of Sullivan and Cromwell?" As a Panamanian, I thought I knew my country's history, and I realized how little did I know. He encouraged me to begin to search after the true story of Panama, which led to a four-year saga and which resulted in the publication of How Wall Street Created a Nation.
So tell us how it began. Maybe you can begin where you began in the book.
Sure. How Wall Street Created a Nation actually describes the journalistic saga that unmasked the true story of how the United States obtained the rights to build the Panama Canal. In 1908, Joseph Pulitzer's newspaper, The New York World, accidentally got a tip that a secret Wall Street syndicate headed by J.P. Morgan and the foxy lawyer William Nelson Cromwell of Sullivan and Cromwell conspired to buy the shares of the then-defunct French Panama Canal Company and then convinced Teddy Roosevelt to buy the rights to build the Panama Canal, or the concessions, from the French for multiples of what they had paid. When Colombia got in the way by rejecting the canal treaty, this American capitalist plotted, fomented, and financed a revolution in the then province of Panama with J.P. Morgan's money and the help of Teddy Roosevelt's warship, and ensured for themselves a enormous fortune. Pulitzer published the accusations without having any evidence. The scandal almost cost the Republicans to lose Congress during the elections of that year, and Roosevelt was furious. He counterattacked with a libel suit against Pulitzer in order to defend himself, the old blind newspaper man who had gone into retirement, actually fled the United States on his boat, the Liberty, and went to Lisbon in the middle of winter, causing the death of his captain, and yet he decided to send his investigative reporters to Paris, Panama, Bogota, and Washington on a three-year campaign to discover the truth about what happened in Panama in 1903.
Joseph Pulitzer was afraid to come off his boat, right? He thought if he landed in the United States that Roosevelt would have him arrested.
Yes, he was sure that Roosevelt would walk over courts, judges, to put him in prison. In fact, he sent his reporters to find the best prisons in the United States in which to spend the rest of his life. And he nevertheless decided...
I hope they did an exposé on prisons in the process.
He made a statement, Roosevelt cannot muzzle the world. So he was going to find the truth. And the reporters gather enormous amount of evidence that led to a Supreme Court case and later to congressional hearings in 1913. However, the case was never conclusively proven because, first, Pulitzer died in 1911, and Roosevelt was able to crash the deliberations of Congress through the help of his friends, Henry Cabot Lodge. With the advent of World War II, grass grew over this episode, except in Latin America, where the taking of Panama was the first of many motivated acts perpetrated by the United States against the sovereignty of Latin countries.
We're talking to Ovidio Diaz-Espino, who is the author of How Wall Street Created a Nation, J.P. Morgan, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Panama Canal. Okay, now let's talk about the French company, the U.S. speculators, and Panama. I don't even know if a lot of people outside of the region understand that Panama at the time was a part of Colombia. And in order to do all of this, the U.S. had to fund a rebellion against Colombia.
Yes. For 400 years, since the arrival of Balboa in Panama, who discovered the Pacific Ocean, cutting a strait through the mountains and jungles of Panama to join the Pacific with the Atlantic coast had been the fractured dream of many European nations. As early as 1529, Roman Emperor Charles V ordered a commission to study the cutting of the canal through Panama. However, it was not until the 19th century, with the advent of the steam power and the electricity, that the dream could come true. And no one represented the spirit of that 19th century more than the visionary French promoter and builder Ferdinand de Lesseps. In 1881, he chartered a company called the Compagnie Universelle pour le Canal Intérieur Sanique, whose purpose was to build the Panama Canal. They raised $250 million at that time, which is an unbelievable fortune today, and mostly from a small French peasants, and started the work of building the Panama Canal. The work was supposed to be finished within 10 years. De Lesseps had already had success with building the Suez Canal. But by 1889, they had not even accomplished one-third of the excavation, and the company went bankrupt. This caused the greatest bankruptcy of all time, led to the downfall of a French Republic, and led to the imprisonment of people such as Gustave Eiffel, the builder of the Eiffel Tower, Ferdinand de Lesseps, and others. In the United States had become also very keenly interested in building a canal through the Straits of Panama. During the Spanish-American War, there was an incident in which most of the battleships were in the Pacific, and they had to move them to the Atlantic to fight the Spanish in Cuba, and it took 3 months to get them across the Cape of Horn. So the U.S. realized that to become a world power, it needed to have an access to the two oceans.
And the big question was whether it would go through Panama or Nicaragua.
Correct. At that time, the favorite route, the one favored by Americans, was Nicaragua. Everybody thought that building the canal through Panama was impossible. If Ferdinand de Lesseps, the builder of the Suez Canal, could not do it, how could anybody else do it? So, therefore, Congress approved a bill to build the Panama, the Nicaragua Canal, using its two lakes. The construction began in Nicaragua. It went to President McKinley, who signed the bill, and it was just up for the Senate to approve it, and the canal in Nicaragua would have become a reality. But at that moment, Wall Street became involved.
And McKinley was assassinated.
McKinley was assassinated, but right before that, right before it happened, the French realized that if a canal through Nicaragua was built, they would lose their $250 million investment. So they came to New York and searched for a man that would not only turn the public opinion towards Nicaragua, towards Panama, but also defeat all of the forces of Congress as well as the approval of McKinley. And they found that man in the Wall Street lawyer, William Nelson Cromwell, who was the lawyer of most robber barons such as J.P. Morgan, Vanderbilt, the Harrimans, and whose specialty was bankrupt companies.
I wonder if the lawyers at Sullivan and Cromwell know about their history. But you're a part of that world. You're a lawyer on Wall Street. We're going to continue this discussion, how Wall Street created a nation, J.P. Morgan, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Panama Canal. Ovidio Diaz Espino is our guest. He wrote the book. And on this 20th anniversary of the death of Torrijos, we'll also bring it right up to, the last years, the years of the Panama invasion, United States, 1989, and how that fits into the picture of what Reagan called any incursion there was a violation of U.S. sovereignty. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. In our next segment, we'll be bringing you part two of our exclusive interview with Lori Berenson from her prison cell in Lima, Peru. It's the first time she is being broadcast, her voice is being heard, since her sentencing by a Peruvian court to 20 years in prison for being a collaborator with terrorists. She denies the charges. But for right now, we're going to continue our discussion with Ovidio Diaz-Espino on his book, How Wall Street Created a Nation, J.P. Morgan, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Panama Canal. Ovidio, how did Wall Street conquer Congress?
It's a very interesting question. The lawyer, Cromwell, went to Washington and started lobbying congressmen to build the Panama Canal instead of Nicaragua, but he got absolutely no reception. In fact, John Tyler Morgan, who was the leader of the Southern Confederacy group in Congress, attacked him publicly in Congress. However, Cromwell did not retract it. The Republicans at that time were in power, and Wall Street was a major donor of many Republicans, including the man who was considered the most powerful in Congress, which was Mark Dollar Hanna. He went to Hanna and offered him a donation of $60,000, which topped even Rockefeller's donation of $50,000 to the Republican Party that year on behalf of his clients, a French company. I wonder whether Hanna thought it was improper to take money from a foreign company to influence his decisions. Likewise, Cromwell went around to all of the other congressmen and reminded them that the Republican depended very much on donations from many of his friends from Wall Street and was able to get the Republicans to block the legislation proposed by the Southern Democrats. But there was something else going on that nobody knew, and that is that in May 1900, a group, Cromwell, organized a secret syndicate, including, among others, J.P. Morgan, E.J. Simmons, Isaac Seligman, Douglas Robinson, who was Roosevelt's brother-in-law, and H.W. Taft, who was the Secretary of War and later President of the United States, Charles Taft's brother, to also begin to lobby Congress. But more than that, they were also began to speculate and purchase the shares of the defunct Panama Canal secret in France.
And so when the U.S. ultimately paid how much?
Well, what happened was that since the collapse of the De Lesseps company, everybody thought that the project was dead and that the stock was worthless. Actually, the bonds of the company were sold in France for about 3 cents on the dollars. Since no one would buy them, the Paris Bourse did not trade them, and they were sold by people, and there were no records of transactions. In 1900, the Cromwell and J.P. Morgan syndicate went to the France and began instructed their French counterparts, which included Credit Lyonnais, the Gustave Eiffel, Ferdinand de Lesseps family, to buy the bonds from the thousands of peasants who owned them. And once they had gotten enough of these bonds, they paid about $3.5 million. Then they turned to the United States and then tried to convince the United States to buy the rights to build the canal, which the French company had, for $40 million, therefore netting $36.5 million, approximately $3 billion in today's money terms.
We're talking to Ovidio Diaz Espino. He wrote How Wall Street Created a Nation, J.P. Morgan, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Panama Canal. Now, how do the Colombians fit in at this point? How did they get access to, how did the U.S. get access to the Panama Canal to build it?
Well, things went very well in Congress as a result of the lobbying efforts of Cromwell, Frenchman, Bruno Varilla. Congress adopted the Panama route despite the opposition from the press and from everybody. Roosevelt at that time became, McKinley died, and Roosevelt became a supporter of the Panama Canal. It was his first major decision in power, and he was risking control over his own presidency. No one knows why he supported Panama instead of Nicaragua, although we do know that his brother-in-law was part of the syndicate. Now, Congress approved the bill, so everything went well in the United States, but now you needed a treaty with Colombia because Panama at that time was a province of Colombia, was not a separate country but only a province of Colombia. And the Wall Street, in fact, it was not the United States who negotiated the treaty with Colombia. It was Cromwell. Secretary of State John Hay basically told Cromwell to go and negotiate a treaty. And Cromwell did end up negotiating a treaty with Colombia in which Colombia would receive only $10 million. And the French speculators and the Americans would receive $40 million. The Colombians didn't like that. They demanded from the French another $15 million. The U.S. was going to pay 50. They said 25 for you, 25 for me, for the Colombians, especially since the concessions were running out in only 1 year. So what the Colombian Congress did was reject the treaty proposed by the United States and signed by Secretary of State John Hay. And the result was the creation of a new republic.
When you were researching this book, I mean, you're not a reporter, you're a lawyer.
Right.
You also went home to Panama.
Yes.
Who were the Panamanians, the sort of nationalist heroes that formed Panama, and how did they tie into the whole U.S. scandal and the syndicate?
Our Thomas Jefferson and George Washingtons of Panama were our Manuel Amador Guerrero and José Agustín Arango. Those are our patriots. They are highly esteemed Panamanians. As it turns out, when Colombians rejected the treaty, Cromwell began to seek the support of Panamanians to liberate Panama and create an independent nation. At that time, he controlled and he was the president of the largest industry in Panama, which was the Panama Railroad Company, which was owned by American capitalists. And there was two men that were reporting to him. One was the doctor and the other one was the lawyer of the Panama Railroad Company. They were Amador and Arango, our two patriots. In other words, our two patriots were hand-chosen by the Wall Street because they reported to the Foxy lawyer William Nelson Cromwell.
So what was the response in Panama as you were writing this book of your family and others?
The response has been extremely critical. This book has been enormously debated. It's even debated in Congress because I reveal facts that they believe hurt the national pride. These are wounds that they felt has been healed with the turning back of the Panama Canal, and that they may be opened. However, the facts are the facts, and my answer to that is it does not diminish Jefferson or Washington to know that even though they signed a Declaration of Independence, they were slave owners too. Likewise, these men...
For many it does.
Well, for some Panamanians, certainly this is something unacceptable. But what happened in Panama was that they summoned Amador to the United States. He came to the offices of Sullivan and Cromwell. They planned the revolution. They got the support of Teddy Roosevelt. And that was very, in doing so, Roosevelt was violating a treaty that it had with Colombia signed in 1847, in which the United States agreed to protect the sovereignty of Colombia over Panama in return for the right of passage and the right to build a railroad in Panama. For 50 years, every time the Panamanians wanted to liberate themselves from the very repressive Colombian government, and what kept the Panamanians from liberating themselves from the Colombian government was actually invasions by the United States. In 1902, the U.S. invaded Panama and quashed some forces that were going to liberate Panama from Colombia. 8 months later, thanks to the influence of Wall Street, the U.S. changed 100 years of history and now began to support the Panamanian revolutionaries.
I wanted to fast forward this to 1989
okay.
and to put the Panama invasion in the context of the whole U.S. relationship with Panama. These were President Bush's words. Don't forget, at the time, it was Cheney who was, right, Secretary of Defense. Old term was Secretary of War, talking about the invasion.
1 year ago, the people of Panama lived in fear under the thumb of a dictator. Today, democracy is restored. Panama is free.
That was President Bush. What about the invasion and how it fits into this history of a U.S.-created Panama?
As you correctly pointed out, the Panama Canal Treaty was signed by Torrijos and Carter. One of the conditions that the United States imposed on Panama is that it had to create a powerful army that would be able to protect the Panama Canal once the United States left. So they took a very disorganized and a small police guard and turned it into a strong military force that was trained with the most sophisticated weaponry in the world. Torrijos was mysteriously killed, and this powerful force ended up in the hands of Noriega.
It was suggested, and we're pulling our sound clips from the Academy Award-winning film, The Panama Deception, but that Noriega may have had involvement in that death, Noriega, who was long on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Correct.
When you look at how the Panama Canal was built, the concern for the many who died in the building of that canal, how many is it believed did die?
Between the French and the Americans, well over 50,000 people died in the construction, mostly from diseases. A lot of them were mostly black Indians that were brought over to work in the Panama during the construction of the Panama Canal.
Well, it sounds like there wasn't much more regard for the lives of Panamanians during the Panama invasion. Again, going back to the Panama deception, a number of reporters were interviewed, although it was very tough for reporters to cover this with a tremendous control of the military. This is from the Panama deception, and this is WBAI reporter Robert Knight describing. He won a Polk Award for his coverage of Panama. Who died in the Panama invasion?
What happened in Panama is a hidden horror. Many of the bodies were bulldozed into piles and immolated in the slums where they were collected. Other bodies were left in the garbage chutes of the poor projects in which they died from the shooting, from the artillery, from the machine guns, from the airborne attacks. Others were said to have been pushed into the ocean.
But that wasn't the main concern of the U.S. press at the time. This was NBC Nightly News at the time that I think 15 U.S. soldiers died.
As we end this program, we hear from President Bush on the high price these young men paid. And we say goodbye to them.
Every human life is precious, and yet I have to answer, yes, it has been worth it.
Here comes Pentagon spokesperson Pete Williams, who became
in
an
the
NBC
months
reporter.
Following the invasion, Panamanians were shocked to discover the existence of mass graves where hundreds, perhaps thousands, of bodies were hastily dumped into pits and buried by U.S. troops.
There was a report of what some were calling a mass grave, which I think is a term that is imprecise.
That was Pete Williams, who became an NBC reporter. This is the head of the Southern Command.
No, I didn't say we had any mass burials. There was one case of some number, but I cannot quote to you that number.
The picture in the Panama deception at that point is women crying over a mass grave, and in the documentary it says that it was believed that a number of these graves, perhaps up to 15, might have been at U.S. bases. As we conclude this discussion, your take on why the U.S. invaded.
Noriega challenged the sovereignty or the influence of the United States in Panama for the first time since 1857. American troops have been present in Panama since 1857. Even the Torrijos-Carter Treaties maintains the neutrality clause, which allows the United States to enter Panamanian territory to protect the canal. And what Noriega did was to challenge that. Through the invasion of Panama, essentially what the United States did was what Teddy Roosevelt had done 100 years later, which is to regain its powerful hand and grip over Panamanian affairs.
I'm going to end this segment with an excerpt from the Panama deception of WBAI reporter Robert Knight, who, this is pretty prophetic, looking from 10 years ago at what the invasion of Panama meant.
The invasion sets the stage for the wars of the 21st century in South America. The 2,000-mile invasion from Washington to Panama City took place primarily with bases from the United States. The essential value of the Southern Command is to get another 2,000 miles of intervention capability, which takes us right into the heart of the Andean coca-producing region, where the wars of the next decade are entirely likely to take place.
I dedicate this program to Robert Knight, who won a George Polk Award for his coverage of events leading up to the Panama invasion. His program, Earthwatch, Its 24-year run, one of the longest at WBAI, was canceled last week by the WBAI general manager. I want to thank you very much, Ovidio Diaz-Espino, for joining us. How Wall Street Created a Nation, J.P. Morgan, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Panama Canal.
Thank you.
It's published by
Four Walls, Eight Windows,
a press here in New York. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look today at Peru, and we're going to go to part two of our exclusive interview with Lori Berenson. Stay with us. To Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The State Department yesterday released the results of an investigation which concludes that the U.S. shared responsibility into the downing of an American missionary plane by a Peruvian fighter jet and a CIA contract airplane on an anti-drug mission in April. The Bush administration suspended the joint anti-drug flights after the shooting, which killed two people, a mother and her baby, but has expressed its desire to resume its cooperation with the Peruvian military as soon as possible. The Bush administration's desire to resume ties with the Peruvian military brings little comfort to those working for the release of imprisoned U.S. activist Lori Berenson. Lori Berenson has been in prison in Peru for more than 5 years. She was first sentenced to life in prison by a hooded military court in Peru on charges that she was a leader of the MRTA, the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, a group classified as terrorist by the Peruvian government. For 3 years, Berenson was held in the frigid Yanamayo prison in the Andes Mountains in an unheated open-air cell without running water, where her hands swelled like boxing gloves from the cold and altitude. She was later transferred to the Socabaya prison, but there, too, she was held in complete isolation for many months. It was there that I interviewed Lori in March of 1999, her first interview with a journalist. We broadcast excerpts of that a year and a half later when she was moved to a Lima prison, and we felt it was safe to air her words. Well, Lori was transferred to Lima after the Peruvian military voided her life sentence and ordered her retried in a civilian court. They admitted she was not a terrorist leader, but were trying her on reduced charges of collaborating with the MRTA. Lori continues to deny the charges. Last month, she was convicted and resentenced to 20 years in prison. Just over a week ago, 141 members of the House of Representatives signed a letter to the Peruvian government, sponsored by New York Democratic Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, urging Lori's immediate release. New York Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Charles Schumer sent a letter to Peru urging Lori's immediate release on humanitarian grounds. Yesterday, Democracy Now! Broke the sound barrier when we brought you the voice of Lori Berenson once again, for the first time since she was sentenced to 20 years by the Peruvian court last month. We'd sent Lori Berenson a series of questions and broadcast her answers from the Chorrillos prison in Lima, Peru. We continue now with the interview we began yesterday. The sound isn't optimal, but these are the conditions under which she was able to do the interview. We pick up by asking Lori if she thinks that the ex-Peruvian President Fujimori and Vladimiro Montesinos played a role in her imprisonment. Listen carefully. Again, Lori reads each of our questions out loud and then answers them.
My next question was, what role do I think former President Fujimori and Vladimiro Montesinos had in my arrest and initial trial? Oh, I think they had a lot of influence. I think all trials in military or civilian courts with hooded judges were political trials that had nothing to do with evidence and a lot to do with politics. In my particular case, yes, my case was a piece that was used as a smokescreen during my the entire detention period, the whole reason I was detained when I was detained, and throughout my period in which I've been in jail. Do I think the trial of Vladimir Montesinos might increase the chances that I'd be released or granted clemency? That's a difficult one to say. I think there are so many people being put into jail under these corruption scandals, and I don't know. I still feel the treatment of them in the press and in general is that of people who even see they've done wrong and now or even repent for what they've done, or I don't know. I mean, I find it so difficult. It's really unfathomable to think that someone who has stolen millions and millions of dollars would now say, oh, yeah, that was wrong. Please forgive me, and they'll probably get out. I really hope that is not the case. But I certainly don't think this will have a positive effect on me. I think it just tends to dissuade public opinion, and they don't even, to the point that people don't even see what really is behind, or where the real big money is, or what the real corruption is about. Can I talk about the prison where I am housed? What is my relationship with the other women who are imprisoned with me? How do they react to my presence? I don't know, that's a sort of unusual question, but I am currently being held in a women's prison in Lima, a prison where actually prison conditions were probably far worse than in most prisons. In this jail, women were only allowed to use pen and paper since 1999. We're only allowed to have basically constant access to books since the year 2000. In general, a lot of restrictions that have to do, and also taking into account that in this particular jail, most people have lower sentences than in the other jails that I've been, and most people don't have life sentences. But, however, the conditions were certainly far, quite brutal, which probably has a lot to do with, to a certain extent, it's a double crime to be a woman and to be accused of a political crime, because it means that that woman has gone against social standards of being involved in anything, in addition to whatever political issues she was involved in. Very notable in the sense of what they've done to children. They let children visit, you know, once every 3 months. Through a mesh screen with no adult presence except their, you know, with their mothers, I guess, and, or a lot of children that were born through because of rape in police headquarters, and then later, you know, if the prisoner wasn't able to find someone to take care of their child, they would give it to the state. It was a very, very, very sad situation. And very, very harsh situation that they have caused on the children of prisoners. And you can see that to date. Okay, how do I view my case and the publicity it has received in comparison to the thousands of other Peruvians who were wrongly tried, tortured, and imprisoned under the Fujimori Montesinos regime? I think my case has been publicized in a more propagandistical way. I think what is similar to most other cases is the truth doesn't much come out. Unfortunately, that is a problem to date because in public opinion, there's an image already created. Certainly, there's more publicity to my case. I would say a lot of negative publicity to my case. I think all Peruvians should have a chance to have the amount of public attention called to their cases, and I would hope that all Peruvians have a greater access to justice than I did. I think that is they have a greater right, than I do, to have that justice. How do I sustain my optimism when I see the conditions of the people around me? I think that has to do with the optimism that I see in those who are in such horrendous conditions, that in spite of the years of detention and the torture that many have been submitted to, and many the suffering that people's families have gone through. A lot of family members detained, a lot of others who are widows, or others who have family members who have been killed, have been persecuted. It's a situation that creates moral strength, and I think it would be wrong for me I think one has to stand tall in spite of that, not give any last I don't know how to say this in English, that little gusto, basically have the government achieve defeating one morally. And I think in that sense it's been very powerful, very a very interesting experience, a very noble experience to have met at this point many people in jail who have just stood tall whatever their beliefs are. I think that's very important. What sort of support do I think I have in Peru, and how do I explain this? I would say in Peru there's a lot of confusion about me, as there is a lot of confusion about everything that has happened in the country over the last 10 years, as I've explained, for the policy of disinformation. I believe that at some point cases as mine and many others will be seen in another light if they are seen with in their true dimension. And I hope that happens soon. Do I think any of the sentiments in Peru against me is motivated by a feeling that Peru is being pressured by the U.S. government? I think that could be a factor. I believe that what Fujimori also used that when he said, no, we're not going to go soft on terrorism, we're not going to listen to the imperials and that kind of thing. I mean, I think that's part of a propaganda kind of thing. At this point, there could be an honest sentiment of that, and I would certainly understand that. I think all Peruvians have a right, and they're actually a greater right than I do, to have justice. I think it's more their right than it is my right, so I would hope it would be understood that it's not my desire to have special conditions or special privileges that others don't have. To the contrary, I would prefer that everybody have those conditions. I think that is what actually Peru needs. Do I think that some of the feelings of the Peruvian people towards me might be colored by their attitudes toward the United States, which supported Montesinos and Fujimori for many years? I don't know, but I do believe it could be interpreted within this sort of anti-North American sentiment on, which also has a lot to do with the economic policies that have directly affected Peruvians, as in all Latin American people. Every news article has said that your second trial was brought about by years of U.S. pressure. In fact, what have the Clinton and Bush administrations done on my behalf? Have I ever been visited by a U.S. ambassador to Peru? And in terms of U.S. pressure, I think U.S. pressure has to do with the fact, is one of the factors that has to do with the new trial. I think U.S. pressure has a lot to do with the constant efforts of family and friends to make my situation known in the United States. I've never been visited by a U.S. ambassador to Peru. Given that the U.S. government is so close to the Peruvian government and military, providing it with millions of dollars in weapons and training, do I think that the U.S. government really wanted you released? That if the U.S. government really wanted me released, that I would be free? I probably shouldn't answer this question, so I'll just leave it there. I certainly have opinions, but it might not be as well understood as I would like it to be. With respect to the question, what would I say to a young person just beginning a life of activism? What would I tell him or her about the risks and rewards of working for social justice? Well, the first thing I would do is I'm always extremely pleased to hear how young people, in spite of I would say that the new economic policies that are presently in effect in the world have a tendency of fomenting or promoting a very, very individualist way of thinking. I believe that those who are able to realize that aspect and to look beyond what society tells them to look at are people who are already have a great social conscience of what moral obligation we all have, all human beings have to do something. I would tell other people that it's really important that all people unite to work for a better society. I think it might have its costs in terms of personal sacrifice and sacrifices of many, many people. But if we don't, if the new generations and if people don't work to that end, I think society will actually get much worse in terms of poverty, in terms of destruction of the environment, which all has to do with poverty and has to do with how that will reflect on greater poverty and greater suffering of human beings. There are so many things with the globalization. You just get the sense. I know it's something that has gotten, I guess it's been a popular topic since I've been in jail. But what I do have a sense of is that basically the interrelation of poverty, hunger, for on one hand, illnesses, destruction of the environment, violation of human and fundamental rights, it's basically a globalized phenomenon, and I think it's very important that people work towards that. It will be a hard uphill battle, but it certainly is something absolutely necessary if we want to look towards the continuation of the human race and any perspectives of greater social justice for the majorities that are actually seeing themselves more impoverished every day.
Lori Berenson speaking from the Chorrillos prison in Lima, Peru, breaking the sound barrier. She has not had access to radio or television reporters since her sentencing. If you'd like to get more information on her case, you can go to the website www.freelori.org. That's freelori.org. We'll be playing you the last part of this exclusive interview tomorrow. Tell your friends. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
This is WBAI Preaching Programs brought to you live with guests in the studio and tape. Just a little program note. Last week, Earth Watch was replaced by UFO, just a hunt for spiff alien abductors and all that stuff. So let's listen to this ongoing soap opera, radio soap opera, and see what's on this Wednesday evening. Meanwhile, you're listening to this station.
I'm Michael Moore, the director of Canadian Bacon and the producer-host of TV Nation. But we all know this is a radio nation. So listen to 99.5 FM WBAI, New York.
This is 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI, La Nueva Alternativa.
La Nueva Alternativa. WBAI.